Bible worm, Bible worm, reading the Bible, Bible worm. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Bible Worm. On Saturday, we ate through one piece of chocolate cake, one ice cream cone, one pickle, one slice of Swiss cheese, one slice of salami, one lollipop, one piece of cherry pie, one sausage, one cupcake, and one slice of watermelon. But we were still hungry. I'm Dr. Robert Williamson, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Hendricks College and Pastor of Mercy Community Church in Little Rock. I'm joined this and every week by my friend and colleague, Dr. Amy Robertson, Biblical Scholar and Executive Director of Congregation Beit HaVerim, a synagogue in Atlanta. We're here every week to discuss the biblical text both as scholars and as people of faith, one Jewish and one Christian. This week we're reading from the book of Acts, chapter 3, verses 1 to 16, in which Peter and James meet a crippled man and restore him to health. We think about evangelism that begins with acts of mercy and turns to preaching the faith only belatedly once people have responded to our compassion. We discuss the power of looking one another in the eye and ponder the miracles that can occur when we move beyond treating each other as transactions and view relationships as opportunities for transformation. And we struggle with Peter's preaching that blames the Jews for the death of Jesus and fails to recognize his own culpability in acts of human violence. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Amy, how are you?
Oh, good morning. How are you?
I've
dodged your question about how I am.
You have. I noticed that was very artful. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I feel like we're in one long blur of like time.
There's this song that is associated with Passover called Karev Yom. And you talk about how a time will come when there will be no day or night, like everything sort of blurs yeah. together. I'm like, yeah,
oh,
yeah,
we made it.
Here we are. We're here. Yeah. There will be no day or night. Yep. Everything's just one big old medium.
Yeah, that's awesome. So the narrative lectionary this week has us in the book of Acts, where we started last time.
Mm-hmm.
We're picking up in chapter 3. The narrative lectionary has us in 1 through 10. And then you and I have decided, after some consternation, to add 11 through 16.
Yeah, do a little wrestling with it.
So we'll talk a little bit more when we get there about why we decided to add that. It introduces both some good theological positives and also some deeply problematic theological negatives.
Yeah, but important to the work that yeah. we're doing as readers of
Absolutely.
This text. So
anything we need to say about...
But what we missed in chapter 2, we missed tongues.
We did.
A tongue landed on each person, and I just really enjoyed that.
Yeah, a tongue image. Of flame. Yeah.
Yeah, so when we left off, they were, the faithful were sort of all together praying, like waiting for the Holy Spirit to move within them and waiting to have some idea of what it is they're supposed to
right,
do next,
right, yeah.
right? And then we get this really dramatic description of what it's like when the Holy Spirit descends upon
yeah.
them. And then here we are. So like they now have sort of this, the Spirit moving within them, and they are to bring it out into the world with all of its, power.
So we're in Acts chapter 3. I'm reading from the Common English Bible. Peter and John were going to the temple at 3:00 in the afternoon, the established prayer time. Meanwhile, a man crippled since birth was being carried in. Every day, people would place him at the temple gate known as the Beautiful Gate, so he could ask for money from those entering the temple. When he saw Peter and John about to enter, he began to ask them for a gift.
I have to say, I find this form of care so interesting. Like, this crippled man is not, it's not that the community ignores him.
Yeah.
Right? There are people who are aware of his situation and want to help him. And the way that they help him is to bring him to a space where he can beg.
Yeah.
And I wondered whether they brought him to the gate of the temple because people are more likely to give, like they're in the mindset of giving because they're thinking about God, or if it's just like a crowded space where they know that he'll get a lot of foot traffic.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I think I probably had processed it as the former. Like, that's still the way it is. You know, like if you have, at least in churches, if you
yeah.
have a community that's down, you know, downtown or wherever, close to poor populations, then people will show up there at service time because they think people are kind of in the giving mode.
Yeah.
But you're right. Like, of all the places where there were people, like the temple precinct, the place to be, probably.
Yeah, it might be a little bit of both. I mean, this is also at, I don't know, intermediate time in Jewish history where they're going to the temple, but they're going to offer prayers and not sacrifices. So I'm a little bit trying to understand where they are.
I mean, I think it's important that Peter and John, the followers of Jesus, are still participating in some kind of a way in Judaism, recognized as, you know, they haven't done anything unusual here. Yeah.
No, they are. They're behaving like they're Jews.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to the daily prayer time at the Jewish worship site. And yeah, there's no separation between them and sort of traditional Jewish practice, as far as I can tell here.
All right. Picking up in verse 4, Peter and John stared at him. Peter said, "Look at us." So the man gazed at them, expecting to receive something from them. Peter said, "I don't have any money, but I will give you what I do have. In the name of Jesus Christ the Nazarene, rise up and walk." Then he grasped the man's right hand and raised him up. At once his feet and ankles became strong. Jumping up, he began to walk around. He entered the temple with them, walking, leaping, and praising God. All the people saw him walking and praising God. They recognized him as the one who used to sit at the temple's beautiful gate asking for money. They were filled with amazement and surprise at what had happened to him.
Isn't that just the most joyful image of him leaping and praising in the temple?
Yeah.
That just fills my heart with happiness.
That's interesting because, I mean, it is. And yet at the same time, like, I almost had this kind of, I mean, I'm a Presbyterian, right? We're kind of known for not being very emotive.
You don't leap much.
We don't leap. Yeah, no leaping at Presbyterian churches, at least in my experience. So I had this moment of thinking, like, is this an appropriate thing to be doing in the temple?
You know, there are those moments that you're overcome, whatever it is you're supposed to be doing or not supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
This man who's over 40 years old and has been every day carried and just sort of laid at the steps of the temple to be in this incredibly vulnerable position, begging for the community to support him enough to get through this day. And then he'll have to come back again tomorrow and ask again.
Yeah.
I don't know. His joy is just palpable. And
yeah, no, that's beautiful.
I like joy, Bobby.
I do too. I do too.
Joy.
Just not at church.
Okay, but I have a question for you about this. I think it's so interesting that a healing story is, again, what sort of kicks off this part of the ministry. I'm assuming that most Christians, this is an assumption, do not think this is a thing that can happen in this way at this time, regardless of your faith. So how do people interact with this story now? Is it just sort of part of the plot, or I don't know, like, how do you think about this?
Well, I mean, so first of all, I mean, what do modern Christians think about miracles varies pretty widely, but in the...
Oh, come on, Bobby, can't you give me a general statement?
But, you know, for a tradition like mine, where we don't really think that much about miraculous healings happening on a regular basis, like, to me, there's a couple of things that are interesting to me about this. First is, like, Peter and John didn't go out in Jerusalem looking for somebody to heal, right? Mm-hmm. This was not like, they're going to the religious service. They're headed to the temple. And this man encounters them on the way. So they are prepared in the moment when the opportunity or the need presents itself, even though it's not on their Google calendar or whatever, they are prepared to do it. The other thing that I think is interesting here is that the way the story is told, you know, their task has been to be witnesses in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. But the first thing they do in Jerusalem, I mean, they did the speaking on the balcony in Acts chapter 2. But like now that we're sort of in everyday life, the thing that they do is they do an act of mercy for somebody in need. And to me, I think that still translates as to, like, you know, what ought Christians to be doing in their communities?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would love to perform miraculous healings, but it has not been something, you know, I have not been gifted with that ability. And so for me to say, well, the parallel is what we do is we lead as a community with acts of mercy and compassion and like restoring people to a more whole life in whatever way we're able to do it. I think it's interesting that in the book of Acts, that's like, the first thing, like, go do an act of mercy. Mm-hmm. It's not, they're not out, they're not evangelizing, you know, they're not handing out Bible tracts, they're not doing any of that stuff. They're just, here's someone in need, and we're going to address that need. To me, that does translate.
Yeah, no, that's really beautiful. That makes a lot of sense to me, that they would head into their mission performing acts of mercy as the opportunities arise.
One of the details of this text that's really interesting to me, so in verse 4, Peter and John stared at him, which is like looked at him intently. And what they say to him is, look at us, which suggests to me that the man has not been looking at them.
Well, that's interesting.
And, it, you know, like in other contexts where you, and I mean, sometimes in the U.S. too, but when you see people asking for money, it is often like their eyes will be averted. Like it's impolite to like look someone in the face and ask them for money. So people will kind of lower their head, lower their eyes, hold out their hands and sort of ask for money. But it's, they're not wanting, I mean, I don't quite know what it is. Like, it's an act of deference or an act of like...
Right, whether it's that looking them in the eye would feel too, I don't know, aggressive, or if it's there's some shame associated with the fact that you're in this position and need to ask.
Yeah, and I think those things are probably related. Yeah, and so that's the way I envision this guy. He's been doing this for however long, like he's 40 years old. He's been doing this for years and years and years. And then here you get these two, and the first thing that they do is they say, look at us. So that just, like, that's interesting to me. Like, the thing they want is for him to meet their gaze.
Yeah. Right. And to have that kind of connection that comes with that.
Yeah.
You know?
Has said, like, you don't have to lead with, I'm a crippled beggar. You can just lead with, I'm a guy. I'm a person like you are.
Yeah, I really like that. I really like that a lot.
In verse 5, the man gazed at them expecting to receive something from them. So, and then they say, well, we don't have anything, but we'll give you what we do have, like here, be healed. That little interaction, like I just, the way that that is told is striking to me for reasons. Like it's just, it's a quirky little way of telling the story.
I mean, it's interesting what you were just saying about the way there is or is not eye contact usually in, you know, as these interactions are in the world today. If there's a person on the street who's asking for money from folks as they walk by, and you're someone on the street and you don't have money to give or you're not going to give money, you usually don't look at them.
Right.
You know, and I think that's part of the, I know I've been in that situation when I don't have money and I have this impulse to avert my own gaze, in part because of my embarrassment of knowing it's the right thing to give, but I can't give. And well, it just sort of creates this whole situation. But as you're saying, that is part of the brokenness, right? That we can't even look at each other in the face of this this situation that is not how it's supposed to be, right?
Yeah.
This is not how the world is supposed to be. And we can't even look at each other. So in some ways, I think that's really true to life. Like once they look at him and say, look at us, he's like, okay, they're going to give me something.
Yeah.
Or they would not have looked at me.
I think that's right. I think that's really well said. I also think that, like, for me, part of what I think makes this telling quirky is because that next line in verse 6 kind of subverts the expectation that, you know, what they give is something, like, totally different than what he was expecting.
Right.
And so one of the things that I sort of have thought is this sort of this thing about asking for money in public creates, there's a script about how that happens. And part of it, like you're saying, is, like, we don't look each other in the eye unless we're going to give something. Right. But I also think there's this kind of sense of like the people are really just kind of parts of a transaction. Like I've got something I'm going to give. Mm-hmm. You're asking for something that you think I'm going to give you.
Mm-hmm.
And so like the humanity can get removed from that. It's just like an ask and a give.
Yes.
And we don't know what to do if that transaction doesn't go that way. We're like, oh my gosh. And so here you have the transaction like two times being kind of disrupted. First by look me in the eye. And then second by, well, I don't have any money. So I'm not going to give you the thing that you think I'm going to give you.
Yeah.
Opens a possibility for something new and different that could happen. So what they do is they invoke Jesus's name and they tell him to get up and walk, which sounds like various miracles that we have seen.
Yeah, we saw all through the Gospel of Mark. Yeah.
And so here you have the disciples kind of, you know, they're connecting their healing ministry to Jesus' healing ministry. Like, they're carrying on the thing that Jesus started, and they're using Jesus' name to do that. Any thoughts about the, like, just the miracle part of the miracle?
I liked the detail in verse 7 that his feet and ankles were made strong.
Yeah.
You know, like the specificity of that, not just he walked, but he walked in the usual fashion, or like through the usual mechanisms. You know, like there was a sense of, I don't know, sort of honor for the bodily form and its strength.
The other thing that I was thinking about that interaction is the kind of, once you have sort of dispensed with the easy money transaction, mm-hmm. it opens up the possibility of seeing something more profound, like a deeper need that could be addressed. You know, if this had just gone with like, hey, could you give me $5? And Peter and John had said, yeah, here you go. Then like that thing just happens so quick, and there's no thinking about like, well, what could happen? Like, what are the possibilities in this situation?
Mm-hmm.
And so the not giving of the money, and the actual like encountering this person, this man as a human being, and you then realize like, oh, there's this whole other thing that's possible, and all that needs to happen, but like his ankles and feet need to be made strong. Like, it is an addressable issue. Like, we're going to address it through the like miraculous power of Jesus Christ, right? But we have gotten to a point where we can imagine transformative possibilities that we could not have imagined if we had just like tossed some money at the guy.
No, I think that's really right. And I think the broader point that, you know, that someone might be asking for a particular thing, which is asking for money, which is their best thought about what's going to help them get through this moment or this day or this week. But that we also should feel invited to think about what it is we have to give.
Yeah.
And it may not be miraculous healing.
Yeah.
And it may not be money.
Yeah.
But we all have things that we can give that will improve the lots of other people in some way.
Yeah.
So I think that's an interesting question.
No, I think that's right. And I mean, part of what I was thinking, like, thank God for the people who gave the man money every day for 40 years, right?
Yes.
Like,
yes, that's right.
The way
we don't want to tear that down.
The reason the guy is able to make it to this moment is because people, gave him money to get through another day. But then here we have people who have a vision for something larger that is possible, a transformation that could happen, that the man himself doesn't even seem to think is possible any longer.
Mm-hmm.
They have a vision for that. And so it's when we think that the giving of the money is the end of the thing, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Not just the thing that allows survival so we can get to a future point, but like, oh, now we've done everything that needs to be done. And this story kind of troubles that idea a little
mm-hmm.
bit.
Yep. Yep. I like that a lot.
So then he jumps up and runs in the temple, and we talked about that a little bit. And what happens in the temple is the people recognize who he is, mm-hmm. and they are filled with amazement and surprise.
One thing that came to mind, it reminded me again of a story in Mark, where I think it was the guy who was like in the cemetery and
mm-hmm.
really troubled by evil spirits or whatnot. And after he's healed, Jesus wants him to stay in the place that he's been. And we sort of went back and forth about why he might want to leave and why Jesus might want him to stay.
Yeah.
And the fact that the people there knew him and know this man in this text who is healed, that is part of, that's part of the power. That's part of the witness, you know? And so that people recognize him first, I think, again, sort of underscores the idea that like he was part of the community. Like people know who he was. He was at the doorstep every day. People sustained him well enough to get through. They didn't solve his problem. So I don't want to let them totally off the hook that they can see the healing of someone that they've known to be suffering for a long time is really powerful and feels really communal, I guess.
So what happens in verse 11 is that the people rush to Peter and John. And then in just a second, Peter and John start to preach, which we'll talk about. But to me, there's something really profound about the order in which this thing takes place, which is Peter and John go out into the world. They encounter someone in need. They treat him like a human being deserving of all the dignity of other human beings. They see past his immediate need, figure out a way to restore him to health. The people are amazed by the transformation that has happened, and they come to Peter and John and they say, "How did you do this thing?" And then Peter and John say, "Hey, let us tell you about Jesus." Right? Mm-hmm. And I just like, to me, that is such a beautiful model of the way that the proclamation of the gospel could take place, mm-hmm. that it leads with acts of mercy. And then when people are drawn to acts of mercy, then there's just an interpretation of like, here's why we do that.
Yeah, that's really beautiful.
My impression, which is, I mean, this is a gross simplification, but my impression of many modern religious communities is that many more conservative traditions are like, the first thing they do is they preach the gospel, and then they're upset when people don't listen to them and they forget about the acts of mercy. Mm-hmm. Many progressive traditions do the acts of mercy, but they never interpret those for the people. Like, they're embarrassed mm-hmm. to say, "We do this because of Jesus." In my mind, this is a really nice corrective to both of those things, where you lead with mercy. And when people are drawn to your mercy, when you're drawn to your healing capacity, then you interpret it for them. I really love that as kind of a model of evangelism.
No, that's really beautiful. And that's a really beautiful demonstration of sort of what it is to witness in the world.
So that is where the narrative lectionary officially ends. But we kind of had thought that it's worthwhile and maybe instructive in some complicated ways, just to look at part of what the actual proclamation of Peter and James is once they've got the crowd's attention. So picking up in verse 11, "While the healed man clung to Peter and John, all the people rushed toward them at Solomon's porch, completely amazed. Seeing this, Peter addressed the people," and then the rest of this is a quote from Peter. "You Israelites, why are you amazed at this? Why are you staring at us as if we made him walk by our own power or piety? The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of our ancestors, has glorified his servant Jesus. This is the one you handed over and denied in Pilate's presence, even though he had already decided to release him. You rejected the holy and righteous one and asked that a murderer be released to you instead. You killed the author of life, the very one whom God raised from the dead. We are witnesses of this. His name itself has made this man strong. That is, because of faith in Jesus' name, God has strengthened this man whom you see and know. The faith that comes through Jesus gave him complete health right before our eyes." Now, Peter's speech continues on from there in 17 through 26, but I think this gives us a flavor of what Peter's whole speech is kind of about. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, the power of God. On the other hand, the rejection of the Messiah.
Yeah, and I just should like tell everyone, when Bobby and I first got on our call today, I was like, "Oh, I'm triggered, Bobby. I'm triggered. This is tough. This is a really tough and triggering text." And I have a lot of, my conversation about this is going to be a little bit of a mess. Like, it's hard for me to separate my emotional self and the history of violence against Jews committed in Jesus' name from texts like this.
Yeah, and that's an important thing for people who are reading this text as religious believers, people who are preaching this text and thinking about, like, what do we do with this text? Like, that's important for us to hear, because, you know, we want to try to take our texts in ways that do good in the world and don't trigger our friends and neighbors and brothers and sisters and siblings and create violence for them, which they historically have done. So could you just say a little bit about, I mean, I think I know, but I'm just curious, like, if you could articulate the ways in which this text is hard for you.
I think just the very start of it, in verse 12, when Peter is addressing the people and says, "You Israelites," as though he is not an Israelite.
Yeah.
And then goes on to say, "You did this. You rejected the holy and righteous one." And I was like, "Hi, Peter. I just read that story, and I'm pretty sure you didn't do any good either."
Yeah.
So much of the power of this story to me is that, yes, there is this, the people who Jesus set out to save. And, like, in my mind, like, theologically, the story is deeply connected to the story of the Jews. And what does it mean for God to have preordained that story to play out as it does in all of its details and all of its horror?
Yeah.
But then to suddenly, like, I feel like it in some ways flipped a switch, and that, like, the culpability, it seems like this was an act of free will, and that the Jewish community did this horrible thing, not that this was a very twisted and complicated thing that I just feel like we moved into a sense of like free will and guilt for the Jewish people yeah. that is not fair and is not, for me, is not in, doesn't seem to be in keeping with the whole theology that this whole thing was preordained.
Yeah.
It makes me mad, Bobby. I disagree with this text. I disagree.
Yeah, and I think in really important ways. And what's really struck me in what you were saying there was the part about Peter. Like, come on, Peter. Like, we've read what you did, right? You
right,
denied...
how is he stepping out of that culpability now?
In my mind, that is a crucial piece of what it means to interpret this text is Peter is here separating himself from the people. And as you noted, his own people, like he's in the temple, you know, worshiping because he's a Jew. And now he's saying like, you people, right? Like as though I'm not one of you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that, to me, it's that separation that is so damaging that Peter mm-hmm. feels like he can say, you did this and I did not. Like in my mind, what Peter ought to be saying is, how did we do this thing? Right? Like, how do we deal with that? And then you think like, oh my gosh, like sometimes people are awful and sometimes people like justice is perverted. And sometimes we get, you know, caught up in political things that make us destroy innocent people. And there's a whole thing one can kind of unfold from there.
Right. That we need to question ourselves and we need to be aware of our vulnerability to forces in the world that will lead to great violence. Like we are all, I feel like that's part of the power of this story to me is it's one thing for a community to sit with this and think about their tie for the story and to think about what are the Jews supposed to get from this story in which their role was, you know, at least according to Luke or according to Acts, what it was. But once you have stepped out of that role and turned it into finger pointing, it's a really, I feel like that just defeats that, it defeats the power of the story.
I think that's exactly right. This is one of those places where this is the kind of stuff that gets me in trouble when I say it, but here's a place where the New Testament does not live into its own ideals in the way that it could. In my mind, the kind of human biases of the author, which cannot handle his own culpability, has scapegoated someone else when the point should be, like, how could we have done this? The point becomes, how could you have done this? And it has had huge ramifications historically. Yeah. Since the, you know, 6th century or something like that.
Right. Right. Especially around this season.
Yeah.
Around the Easter season when there's a focus on the horror of the story, so, you know, as much as the beauty of the story of the resurrection, the horror of the story of the crucifixion. And if you've found someone else, someone who you don't identify with, that you can project that horror onto so you don't have to hold the horror together with the beauty.
Yeah.
Well, that's nice. That's nice for you.
Yeah.
You know, that you can just sit with the beauty. But yeah, I mean, the histories of violence and pogroms against the Jewish community around this time of year because of this kind of thing is horrifying and certainly does no honor to Jesus's name.
Yeah, that's really well said. I think for a modern reader, if we're thinking like, what does it mean to be a Christian and read this text? And what I think you're suggesting is really powerful and important to say, like, we need to like undo that move at the very beginning where Peter says, you did this and I didn't. And if we could say humanity is capable of these things,
mm-hmm.
then the conversation becomes very different.
In a certain way, I feel like there is, I hesitate to use the word truth because it can be taken in so many different ways, but there are things about this text that are true to life. When we are asked to really look in the face of the horrors that we ourselves might have committed or see our capacity to do things that in retrospect were clearly terrible.
Yeah.
The very first thing you want to do is say, I didn't do that.
Yeah.
That wasn't me.
That's exactly right.
And so I think this is, in that way, this text is really true to life, to sort of watch the community of Jesus process what just happened here.
Yeah.
But if we take this text as like, if you take Peter out of that and say, no, Peter is an apostle and a teacher, and what he is teaching is like capital T true instead of an example of genuine human wrestling.
Yeah.
That's where we run into trouble.
I think that's a really rich way of reading this text. What are the ways in which we are trying to cover up our own culpability in horrors that are taking place around us? When you think about modern reading of this text, that's one really helpful way of getting at it, I think. Are there other things that you see in this text that you would take away, either as like encouragements or as warnings?
I think one question that has sort of been in my mind since, you know, when I read that the Acts version of what happened, which is a little bit different than when we saw in Mark, in the Gospel of Mark. I went back and read the Gospel of Luke to see how Luke narrates the scenes around the crucifixion. And I just started thinking about the role of the crowd and individuals within the crowd throughout the story of Jesus and their sort of fanatical following of him.
Yeah.
And then such a quick turn against him. And I'm really sort of sitting with like, do crowds behave in this way? Like, do people behave in this way? Where do crowds behave in this way? Like, I started thinking about, you remember Howard Dean?
Yeah.
He was a presidential candidate like a long time ago. Well, I don't know if he was really a candidate. He was in the primary.
Yeah.
And my recollection of that was that he was very, very popular until one strange video of him like yelping with excitement.
Yeah.
That people just didn't like that video. And that was it. Like, that was the end. It was the quickest turn. It was just the quickest turn I've ever seen. So
for a completely ridiculous reason. Yeah.
For such a ridiculous reason. Yeah. And so I guess it got me thinking a little bit. I mean, again, like a cautionary note towards the power of crowds, but how crowds function and how crowds function in relationship to political or religious leaders, and that the fanatical nature of support and of rejection of those leaders for no particularly good reason. Because if you read the story of the end of Jesus's life, nothing really happens to change the crowd's opinion that I see. Yeah. It's like Jesus yelped at the wrong moment and then people were done.
There's some sense in which the religious leaders are stirring the crowd up.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the ease with which the crowds are kind of swayed by nothing.
Yeah. By nothing has actually really changed.
That's it. There's nothing that has actually happened, but there is kind of this like, I mean, propaganda, I guess, that's being put out there that sways people. Yeah.
So I don't know. That's another thing that I'm thinking about.
Yeah, no, I like that. And that's in the background. Like that's related to the point you were making earlier. Like if you, instead of putting the crowd over there somewhere and say shame on them, to say like, in what ways are we susceptible to this kind of crowd dynamic, and how do we subvert it?
What stands out to you in this text for today, Bobby?
This text to me is really rich. And, you know, part of it was what I was saying earlier about the way that I think kind of Christian mission, Christian witnessing ought to take place, which is leading with acts of mercy. And then when people are drawn to your acts of mercy, then you interpret the story. That to me is really important.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
The second thing is this, the way that Peter and John interact with this man that they encounter. Like, you know, I spend a fair amount of time at Mercy Church with people who are living on the street, people who are, you know, flying a sign, trying to get money from folks. And the thing that is most hurtful to people is that they cease to be seen as human by like the vast majority of people who pass them by. And so, you know, like not being looked at in the eye is like the best case scenario. Like people are often like yelled at, or like horrible things are said to them, or, you know.
Yeah.
And so this thing that Peter and John do is such a simple thing. But when they say, look at us, like first they gaze at him, like they look at him intently, which I take to mean like they're taking him seriously. Mm-hmm. And then they say, hey, stop averting your gaze. Like, look us in the eye. to me, that is them saying, we are treating you as just one of us. You happen to be crippled and in need of money. We happen to not be, but we're like, we're the same, you and I. To me, there's the healing has already started in this text when that happens. I mean, that's such a simple thing that one can do is just like, don't make distinctions between who's rich and who's poor or who's healthy and who isn't and who, you know, can walk and who can't. Like, we're people. We're all in this thing together. Different ones of us have different strengths and different weaknesses. Mm-hmm. And then when Peter and John take the time to look at him as a human being, a fellow human being, they see a possibility of transformation that is beyond simply the giving of money. Mm-hmm. So in my mind, that is like the more that people with resources can spend building relationships, getting to know people mm-hmm. who are in different circumstances, mm-hmm. stepping outside of our privileged bubbles mm-hmm. and sort of understanding the reality of people who are out there who for whom the world is not a friendly place. Like, what kinds of transformations are possible beyond the simply, like, it's important that people have the resources to survive another day.
Right.
It is more important, or like additionally important.
Yes.
That we think about ways of transforming the world in more profound ways that may not seem possible at first glance, but in fact are.
You know, hearing you talk about sort of your experience with the community at Mercy Church and the kinds of transformation that are possible when we look beyond the provision of daily sustenance, which is an important thing for sure. It made me think about the Jewish concept of tikkun olam, which is, you know, the healing of the earth. And there is a temptation sometimes in some Jewish communities to equate that with charitable giving.
Yes.
Tzedakah, which is another thing and a wonderful thing, and everyone should give tzedakah. And the ways in which the world needs to be healed are much more profound than that. And I think exactly as you're saying, start with the rupture between people and the fact that suddenly you don't understand the other person's experience. You might not see them as fully human. You might not understand that you have things to learn from them and they have wisdom.
Right.
It is not just that I have money and so in my great goodness, I will give it to you.
Right.
But ways to sort of heal that relationship and form that connection are a much bigger part of the healing that needs to happen.
Yeah, I love that.
Are we out of Acts next week? We are in...
We're
not. We're still in Acts, but we're all the way in chapter 17. It is church at Thessalonica.
Oh, yeah.
I lived there.
Did you really?
Thessalonica.
Yeah.
I can tell you the story of Little Red Riding Hood in Greek, which I learned while I was living there. This is going to be a great podcast. Y'all
I cannot wait for that.
It's going to be amazing.
You've given me a little brief preview
just
once.
A little brief preview. I'll practice my voices. If the voices come back.
I cannot wait.
This is how we entertain ourselves during self-isolation, people.
Yeah.
Well, it's always a pleasure talking with you.
Likewise.
I'll talk to you again next week.
All right. See you then.
All right, y'all take care.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Bible Worm. We'll see you next time for selections from Acts 17 and 1 Thessalonians. We'll see you then.